This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between, because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Into the 9 o'clock hour we go, 9:09, and hearing that Pope Francis, and look, God bless him, man, because you know at 88, and having been through it with elderly parents that were very ill, it's hard to fight back from something like that and not just give up. And just, you know, anybody that's been through knee replacements or any kind of thing like that knows, or any accident, or you got to go through the rehab to get your strength back and everything else. And God bless him to do that. And he had a meeting today about new saints. And I'm just thinking, maybe Patrick Mahomes in a black and gold? That wouldn't be a bad idea. A couple of linebackers, corners, people can rush a passer. While you're at it, Pope Francis, if he can. Of course, we probably just kind of wandered into miracle range. But Matt Range joins us now, author of The Big Book of King Cake. How you doing, Matt? Happy Mardi Gras.
Yeah, you too. I'm doing great. I'm excited for some parades. How are you, Tommy?
I'm good. You know what I'm thinking? Kind of like, I don't know if I addressed this last time with you or not, but kind of like Kramer, but it would be a King Cake book that actually is a King Cake. What do you think? It's edible.
I think you might have actually mentioned this last time, because at least somebody did, and it seems like it might be something that you came up with. It's a good idea.
It does sound like something I would come up with, and again, the memory is not what it used to be, so maybe I did mention it. But and think of the books you'd sell.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, see, I thought because, about doing like a King Cake advent calendar or something like that in the month leading up to it, which would be delicious also.
But if the book was a King Cake, you would eat it when you finished reading it, and then you'd have to do what?
Buy another King Cake book.
Tell me about your book, seriously, because it is. Did you update it at all, and have you discovered any new King Cakes? Tell me about your journey.
Okay, so the book is now in its fourth print run. So there were some kind of minor updates, but really most of my time, right, I'm creating the Big Book of Po' Boy right now, That's where most of my efforts are. I'm always trying new King Cakes, and so definitely probably like, I don't know, 10 years from now, maybe I'll do a big update. But the book itself is kind of meant to be a snapshot of King Cake in one specific time. And so it features 75 different New Orleans bakeries and the stories behind each of their unique King Cakes with, you know, 1,000+ beautiful photographs, amazing stories about how each of these bakers and their own personal journey led to their unique, specific, original type of King Cake. And so, for example, a Honduran bakery who wanted to create some sort of Honduran version of Louisiana's King Cake tradition, so put some guava and cream cheese inside. Or like the story behind Dongfang's bakery and how their King Cake, why it has those ridges, it's because she was a seamstress before she came to New Orleans after the Vietnam War. So there's lots of great stories in the book as well.
I kid you not, and I talk about Maurice French pastries, but I clicked on the Big Book of King Cake, and I just clicked on an image, and it turned out to be Jean-Luc Albin's page about Maurice French pastries, and you have a quote in there from him saying, if I was back in France and I could only make two types of King Cakes, I probably would have changed careers. That's part of the story as well, right? About the different bakers and how they were inspired to do these kinds of things?
Yeah, exactly right. That's kind of what, so when I started creating the book, I thought it was going to be just a book about these beautiful cakes. It kind of my personal story is that one year I was invited to a king cake party, and this was before I was a writer. I ended up eating 88 different kinds of king cake just in preparation to figure out which king cake I wanted to bring. And so I kind of carried that over into the creation of the book, thinking, oh, this is just about, like, look at these cool different kinds of king cake. But as I started to interview bakers like Jean-Luc, I was like, oh, my God, each of these bakers has such an incredible story. None of these, this sushi king cake, for example, or Jean-Luc's French style of king cake, they're all based on their own personal stories. And so I kind of got obsessed with that idea. And here in Louisiana, we're really, there are king cake traditions, and I talk about this history in the book as well, all across Europe, as well as in Mexico. There are, all of these different countries have a version of king cake, and they, you know, look a little bit like ours, but kind of different. They have different names, but it all translates to kind of cake of kings, roughly. But the unique thing about Louisiana king cake is we're the only ones who tie it to Carnival and Mardi Gras rather than Christmas. And we're the only ones who allow for this huge amount of creativity that other places kind of don't. They have their one traditional kind, and that's it. We have obviously our traditional kind, too. And I think it's really fun that we have this battle between, you know, traditionalists who love that Mackenzie-style king cake, and then people who are willing to kind of maybe try to evolve a little bit. And through that, I think we get a really fun season of king cake eating.
I saw somebody on social media the other day post a picture of the traditional dryer king cake with the phrase, warning choking hazard, which I thought was funny, however not very nice, but it can be kind of dry. When it comes to the Mexican type, I think I saw one of these maybe at Rouse's at the beginning of the season with like a yellow, gold, and black icing or something like that. Does that make sense to you? They called it something besides a king cake, and it did appear to be in Spanish.
Oh, interesting. So in Mexico and Spain, it's called the Roscón de Reyes or the Rosca de Reyes.
That's what it
which
was.
Again translates to cake of kings, and their tradition is so interesting. And so it's on January 6th and only January 6th, you know, the 12th night of Christmas, which is where our king cake used to be. The same thing in Louisiana. You'd only eat king cake on January 6th. But in Mexico, that's still the case. And they have a plastic baby inside the king cake as well. Here in Louisiana, there's a little bit of a debate about whether the baby is meant to be baby Jesus or not. Mm-hmm. In Mexico, it's unanimously agreed on that it's baby Jesus. And so you, whoever gets the baby inside the Rosca de Reyes, hangs on to that baby. And on February 2nd, which is, you know, in the Bible is when Mary would have brought Jesus to church for the first time. You are meant to bring baby Jesus to church on a day that's called Candlemas. And then you host a tamale party on that day on February 2nd. So it's kind of a different tradition, but same general idea.
What about just the history of this? Because for people, you know, we got people moving in the area all the time. They got people shipping king cakes all the time. And maybe we don't quite realize what it is that we're doing or how this all started. Give me the quick history of king cake, the 2-minute version, if you can.
Yeah, sure. And so it goes all the way back to ancient Rome. And so a lot of people say that king cake, they believe it began in France. The ancient Romans were doing something very similar, though it wasn't about Mardi Gras and it wasn't called a king cake. It was celebrating the Saturnalia, which was basically in the month leading up to December 21st, the winter solstice, which is when Saturnalia was celebrated. The sun was, in their viewpoint, the Romans believed that the sun was dying. You know, it was getting lower in the sky at its apex every day. The nights were getting longer, days getting shorter. But on December 21st, winter solstice, that all turns around. The sun is rising higher in the sky each day. Days are getting longer. And so they saw that as the return of the sun, S-U-N. And so that was worthy of a celebration. They'd eat too much, drink too much, wear colorful costumes, parade in the street. And in the middle of their feast, they'd have a cake that was round like the sun and circular like the sun. Think kind of like the galette des rois, the French version of king cake. Mm-hmm. And inside that cake would be a fava bean. And whoever got the slice of the cake with that fava bean inside would be crowned king or queen of the Saturnalia, similar to what we do now. You're crowned king or queen of your classroom or your break room, and you have to buy the next king cake. But in Rome, you didn't have to buy the next king cake. Rather, you were sacrificed to the gods. So it was a much higher stakes thing. That eventually spreads out around all across Europe. Christianity kind of takes the tradition over, and they make it about Christmas time, the 12th night of Christmas, and celebrating the three kings.
If you could use your imagination, because you've tried, how many did you different types of cakes have you tried total?
At this point, probably 300 and something, I would guess, something like that, many, many.
So if you could create one of your own, going back to what Jean-Luc said, what would you like to see? Where do you see King Cakes going, Matt? Because you wrote the – you want to talk about the little book as well, but tell me, where do you see this going?
This is great. I've never been asked this question, the King Cake that I would create. So I'm a New Yorker originally, which makes people, you know, gasp and frown sometimes. But, you know, fell in love with New Orleans and fell in love with King Cake, and I've been here for 16 years. But, you know, I loved three-color cookies. Were like my favorite thing, those rainbow cookies, you know, which my mom would always have on Long Island around the holidays. And so I always said that I would want to make a three-color cookie king cake, maybe with that, you know, flavoring inside and then maybe some three-color cookies on top. But then I saw this year somebody actually created it, this place, Balboni's King Cakes. They made a three-colored cookie king cake, and it's awesome. So.
Is it the same as like a black and white cookie? Because there you go. What about a black and white king cake, like a black and white cookie?
It's a great idea, and I've not seen anybody do that, so that's a really good idea, too. You're full of them today.
Yeah, I am. I'm full of a lot of stuff. Tell me about the Little Book of King Cake.
Sure. So the Little Book of King Cake, so basically I for years, have taught this after-school program. And I teach these third graders and, you know, creative writing. And so after I wrote the Big Book of King Cake, I brought it to them. I thought they'd be like, holy cow, Mr. Matt, you're the coolest guy. You wrote this book. But I forgot that third graders are pretty mean.
Yeah.
And so one of them was like, why would you write a whole book about King Cake?
Really?
So I was like, okay. Yeah.
Seriously?
So, I was like, yeah.
So you're
walking in
all full of yourself, feeling pretty good, right? I'm Matt Haynes. Yeah, Little Book of King Cake. I'll go ahead and read for the kids. Why would you write a whole book about King Cakes?
I know. I got humbled, but then it kind of gave me the idea, oh, maybe it's something that we kind of take for granted a little bit. And so I thought, let me write this kid's book about what makes King Cake special. And it's the story of Miley. She's a third grader, and she gets the King Cake baby at school. So she has to bring the next King Cake, but there are so many different kinds. How could she decide which one to bring? In her dreams, the King Cake baby gets real big, flies her around to 7 real New Orleans bakeries, and at each bakery, the King Cake tells her kind of what makes their version of King Cake special, whether it's tradition or the history or the special fillings and things like that.
One thing I did want to ask you about is, what do people tell you about the book? I'm sure you've gotten some feedback on it. The Big Book.
Yeah.
Or either one.
I've sold now, at this point, you know, 23,000 copies.
Wow.
In the last couple of years. And so people seem to love it. You know, it's fun. My favorite thing that I see some people do as they get really obsessed with it is they will take it around to all of the different bakeries and have the baker sign them.
Oh, that's a good
idea. They kind of use it as a guide. And that makes me feel great, because part of the reason of the book is a celebration. You know, a big reason of the book is it's a celebration of the city's bakers and their creativity. And when people use the book to celebrate them, that makes me feel really good.
Anything surprise you when you're writing a book, doing a research about the King Cakes, a genuine surprise or inspiration from a baker?
I mean, for me, the biggest surprise was just the unbelievable, you know, history behind the cake. But then also, I think, you know, as a journalist, it's something that I've really kind of adopted now as something that I think about when I'm interviewing people, is that just these stories, like the things that the Tran family from Dongfang Bakery had to go through before they started their bakery, or the things that Martha Gilreath at Nolita Bakery had to go through before she was able to start her bakery. And she was addicted to drugs and homeless, and now she's on the Today Show and winning all these awards with her King Cake. All of these amazing journeys, and how it's these stories that every single King Cake has a story behind it. I was so surprising to me.
Well, and that's what I love about the book, because like you, I think everybody has a story. And if you ask the right questions, everybody's story is interesting. Really, everybody has an interesting story. Believe it or not, they do. Tell me about the Bo Boy book. How's that coming? And what kind of research? Well, first off, what size pants do you wear? You got to be like in a 48 waist or something. How do you handle all this?
When I did
So I read in USA Today that the majority of people stop GLP-1 weight loss injection shots in a year. Now, what's concerning is if you get off GLP-1s, there's a real chance you can gain all the weight back. The solution? Almacid, a natural superfood protein shake. University studies show it optimizes your metabolism so you can lose weight easily, and Almacid has been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Use Almacid with GLP-1s or as a natural alternative. Find out more and see the university studies at almacid.com. That's A-L-M-A-S-E-D.com.
true crime fans will love Crime House True Crime Stories, a Crime House original podcast. Every Monday, you'll experience the most notorious true crime cases from that week in history, all linked by a common theme. From serial killers to disappearances to unsolved murders and so much more. Follow and listen to Crime House True Crime Stories, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Crime House Studios, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Those 88 king cakes. I was single, and I just was like, oh, I'm going to only eat king cake. And so
wait,
calorically,
did you do the
I was fine.
Did you do the king cake and beer diet? Was that you or was that somebody else?
I mean, it sounds like what I was doing. It was basically, calorically, I was okay. Health-wise, I'm sure it was terrible.
That was you that was doing it. I remember that now. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. And then when I did the book, and now with the Po' Boy book also, my girlfriend is like, maybe you should eat like a salad in addition to these king cakes. And those extra calories are kind of really screwing me over here because I'm definitely gaining some weight. Also, I think my metabolism is getting slower.
Yeah, well, it happens as you get older. Matt, I hate to tell you that, but it does happen.
Yeah.
Maybe some aerobic activity too. You know, maybe hit the gym or something. Couldn't hurt.
I try to go for a jog in Ottoman Park most days, so that helps too.
Tell me when the Po' Boy book is going to come out, or do you have a date yet?
Yeah, it should be around November 1st. We're kind of in the home stretch. I was just in here doing some writing, before I jumped on here, we've got go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just saying, before we run out of time, give me a preview of an interesting story you've heard in your research for the Po' Boy book.
Yeah, so like at Shortstop Po' Boys out in Metairie, it was such an interesting thing because I've heard this story now a couple of times that they were basically a grocery store before they became a Po' Boy shop. But and back when they were a grocery store, construction workers would come in and one guy would buy a French loaf of bread. One guy would buy a head of lettuce and some tomatoes. One guy would buy a can of mayonnaise. One guy would buy some cold cuts, and they'd all sit on out in the parking lot together and just put their po' boys together themselves.
No.
Now, as big grocery stores started to pop up, those smaller groceries couldn't really compete with them, and so that's when places like Shortstop started to shift to making their own po' boys and then eventually just becoming a straight-up po' boy shop. And so stories like that have been really fun to hear and learn about and put things into context for myself as I'm doing the book.
Everybody's got an interesting story. Matt Haynes is good at telling them. Matt, if people want to order a book, can they order from you and you'll sign it, or how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. If they go to www.thebigbookofkingcake.com, you can order either of the two books, and eventually the Po' Boy book will be up there as well. And then there's an area for you to write down that you want me to sign and personalize, and I'm happy to do it before I ship it to you, or we can do like a local pickup or something.
That's awesome. It's thebigbookofkingcake.com.
That's right. Exactly right.
Thank you, sir. A pleasure as always. Happy Mardi Gras.
Yeah, you too. Talk to you soon, Tommy. Thank you.
Go run. 9:24, back in a flash with Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist. We're going to talk about a new recent survey showing a third of Americans felt burnout at their job in the past year. Have you, and how do you deal with it? Back in a flash, WWL. Well, it just so happened the name of this song is Psychotic Reaction. We didn't do it on purpose, but we're going to talk to Dr. Judy Ho, our friend, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, author of The New Rules of Attachment and Stop Self-Sabotage, mother of Luca, 5'7" of brains and beauty and brawn, and a mother of Luca. And I don't know, I'm running out of things to say here. Dr. Judy, how you doing?
We're laughing.
I know.
Hey, Luca
asked why we're laughing.
Let's say hi to Tommy. Say hi, Tommy.
Hi,
Hey, Luca. How you doing, buddy?
He's good. He just woke up. So he's a little sleepy. You know, can't give toddlers coffee yet. So.
No. Well,
I am enjoying coffee, but yeah, no, I don't want to give this kid coffee. He's so hyper already.
You'd be sorry. Then again, you can always offset with some cough syrup. I'm just kidding. You don't ever want to do that. Let's talk about, we're going to talk about burnout, but earlier we had somebody on talking about scams and romance scams online and so forth. And I just thought it'd be interesting to ask you about when it comes to dating and appropriateness of money and warning signs, when somebody asks you for money, how do you navigate that whole thing? If you got a relationship with somebody, unless you're married or something or sharing funds, I don't know how you handle all of that. Take me through that. You're the licensed clinical neuropsychologist.
Yes, it's so hard. I think that it's very, very hard to navigate. And I think most people would probably agree it's not a good idea to get entangled in finances and loaning, borrowing from friends and family members as much as you can avoid it, only because it tends to cause a lot of friction. Oftentimes it ends in resentment. So I think you just have to have a really clear boundary. Like, what is your financial boundary? Are you willing to help somebody out up to a certain amount? You know, are you just not willing to loan anyone money ever? Kind of have a clear vision in your head, because at some point you'll probably be asked, you know, and so it's just good to know. I know some people, and I think I myself am included in that, I'm more comfortable for sure loaning money to people than I am asking people for money. Mm-hmm. But the problem is sometimes when I loan people money, it's really awkward when I have to ask for it back. So if you think that you're going to be that person and it's going to be hard for you to get your money back, then you might just have to reshift it in your mind. Like, let's say that somebody wants to loan $500 from you and it's a really close family member or a good friend. If you're that person, you may just have to say, okay, it's almost as if I'm not going to get this money back. It's like I'm giving them a gift. And if I never get it back, then I'm okay with it. You know, so you just have to decide what you're truly okay with, what you're not, because I've seen this really tear apart families and friendships.
Let me, I want to open that Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text line here at 504-260-1870. And let me know if anybody's either asked you for money, a friend or relative, or if you've asked to borrow money, because I'm thinking, Dr. Judy, I don't know that anybody's ever asked me to borrow money.
Oh, interesting.
Maybe they knew the answer was no, or they knew I'm always broke. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know.
Maybe they're like, he's not going to give us any money. I can tell.
Right. But generally speaking, when it comes to a relationship, if you're starting to date somebody, if they ask you for money, mm-hmm. that should be a big warning time, should it not?
A big warning sign, I think so. Yeah, I do think so. And I think that you don't want to be a sucker, right? So maybe it's just that you, Tommy, you just wear your boundaries, you know, more clearly. Some people just kind of look like, oh, well, you know, sure, I'll be a pushover. I'll give it to, you know, maybe you're just not that person. People ask you for other things, but not for actual money for that reason. And I think that sometimes when you're in an early dating relationship and that conversation goes right to borrowing money, of course, that's a warning sign. It doesn't matter how much money you have or how little. The fact that they're already making it transactional at such an early stage, I don't think that that's necessarily a good roadmap for a long-lasting, loving relationship, because you would hope that this person has other people in their life who they have more solidified relationships with, whether it's family members, good friends, or very good colleagues, where if they were in a pinch, they'd be asking those individuals because that relationship is much more established.
You know, somebody texted.
So I do think that's a sign.
Somebody
yeah.
texted this in, and I think it's a good point that you should never, ever begin dating anybody with serious credit problems because inevitably, or serious debt, because inevitably it is going to come back and affect the relationship. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like obviously you have to make sure you don't make too many lists of no's before you even give the relationship a chance. But if you do learn that the person has a lot of financial debt, I mean, that means that you probably have to bump up the timeline for when you're going to have that conversation about financial values, right? Because for a relationship to work, you have to have similar values in a lot of different ways, whether it's about family, how you spend your time, you know, all of those things are important to talk about. You know, sometimes with people, religion and spiritual beliefs, that's important to discuss. But the financial discussion is always awkward and people delay it a lot, but eventually it's going to cause friction. And if you know that they're in debt or you see the way that they spend, your concerns, you might have to have that conversation a little earlier so that you really understand the full picture and whether or not you can get on the same page eventually. I mean, if this is a person who's saying, look, I've made some dumb decisions in my youth. I'm trying to get, you know, financially solvent now. If they have a clear plan, I think that that's fine. You know, you can talk through that. You might have to stay on top of them a little bit. But they're continuing to spend money, being really just reckless with it. I do think that if you guys end up in a long-term relationship, you will have to assume that financial responsibility sooner or later. And I know that one of my best friends, you know, him and his spouse, they both went to grad school. He was able to keep his financial
loans to a minimum, but hers was actually very high. It was a six-digit number, and he didn't realize that until they got married. And there was that did cause resentment in the relationship for at least a few months, because now him making all these responsible financial decisions, now it was his job to get both of them out of debt because now they're married. And, you know, he's the only one who was able to do it out of the two of them. And he didn't learn that until after they got married, right? So just have that conversation early so you know what you're getting into.
Let me take a break. We'll come back, talk about burnout, and you can ponder this during the break. I've been divorced 12 years. At no point did anybody ever say, you know what, Tommy, you'd be perfect for, or you know what, Tommy would be perfect for you. 938, 22 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:44, 16 till 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL. We are always concerned about mental health here, so we every couple of weeks talk to Dr. Judy Ho, our friend, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Dr. Judy, this study says that nearly a third of Americans felt burnt out at their job in the past year. How do you describe that's not a clinical diagnosis, right? Burnout, or is it?
Yeah, burnout is not a clinical diagnosis, but it overlaps with other diagnoses, especially depression. So sometimes people have a difficult time determining if it's just burnout or if they're also then slipping into maybe a clinical depression. But either way, what we know is that chronic burnout has a lot of deleterious mental health and physical health effects. And so essentially, if you have chronic burnout, you are going to increase your risk to a host of medical and psychological concerns, which is why it's so important to notice it and address it.
Is it inevitable, burnout?
I don't think it's inevitable, but I do think that it's very common. So if you, depending on the research that you look at, it looks like about 3/4 of Americans who are working, because we're talking about occupational burnout, at some point will say that they have been burned out some of the time or most of the time. So that's a big statistic, right? It's basically 3 out of 4 people are going to experience this, not just a few days a week from time to time. They're either going to feel like, well, probably half the time I'm feeling burnt out, or most of the time I am. And that, I think, is a really big statistic to pay attention to.
Maybe I'm old school here, but I always, you know, and I told my kid the same thing. It's like, well, you know, if it's fun, you pay them to do it, right? But if they pay you, well, then it's going to be a grind, and I don't care what you do, if you're Patrick Mahomes or if you're Tiger Woods or if you're Florence Pugh, I don't know, give me an actress, anybody, no matter what you do, what you do, Dr. Judy, no matter what you do, at some point it becomes a grind. Don't you have those days?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love my job overall, but it's called a job for a reason. I think that's what you were implying.
Right.
And I think that you have to have expectations. Oh my goodness, Luca is yawning at our conversation. He's like, oh, this is a bore. I don't have to work. But yeah, I think that
get ready, buddy. Your time's coming.
Exactly. Enjoy these years. But you know, I think that maybe especially the younger generation, at least just from what I'm observing, of course, this is great that you want to hope for a career that is inspiring, that you love. But I think that sometimes that sentiment goes overboard and people start getting really disillusioned because they think that they're supposed to love their job all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that if the expectations were set in such a way that, hey, you know what, I do enjoy what I do, but there's going to be days or certain activities that I have to do as part of my job that I don't enjoy doing. If you can just set your expectations in a more realistic place, I actually think that that's one of the secrets to reducing burnout, because burnout has 3 main components. One is emotional exhaustion, like just feeling like no matter how much rest, how much sleep you actually get, you just feel tired. Another one is feeling like you're not as good at your job, even if people are telling you you're good. You just don't feel like you're being very effective. And then the third one, which I think in some ways can be the most insidious one that people don't notice, is that you start to have this really cynical way of looking at your job, your life, the people that you're working with, and you just start to distance yourself from empathy and from really connecting. And I think that that's the one that is the most gradual that people don't see, but it has some of the worst side effects. And I think that people tend to feel that way when they start to think well, this job is supposed to be fun all the time. Why is it not always fun? And then you just start distancing yourself from all the goals that you set. And I think that that's just an important thing to realize, is that no matter what amazing job that you're calling, there's going to be some people you don't like dealing with, some parts of the job that you don't like, and that's so normal.
Somebody texted in about having a grown child that's in the 20s, having a hard time deciding what they want to do, and is there a way to go through a discernment process that would prevent possible burnout, and how do you help counsel somebody or advise them as to what their, I don't know if I'm use the word vocation, or what it is that they're determining what they want to do in life or what they're meant to do, or how do you go about that? Because you got to balance it with, you know, you got to enjoy it, but you still got to be able to provide for yourself and your family as well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I would say that it's really helpful to take some established career inventories or personality tests to try to help them to know what their interests are and where their skills are. So a couple of the most famous ones that are used all the time that anyone can have access to, I mean, of course, you have to pay on the website to take the inventory, and then they give you essentially a breakdown and analysis as well as job descriptions and suggestions for which jobs you might be the most interested in or your skills would be the best equipped to. One of the most famous ones is called the Strong Interest Inventory. Again, anyone can get access, can just search it in Google. Another one is called the Kierzy Assessment. That also helps you to understand how your personality traits might contribute to certain types of work environments. So Kierzy is spelled K-E-I-R-S-E-Y. I think those two things are great. You know, I would also say that, as we were just talking about, Tommy, especially the younger generation, they're having a harder time with this discernment process. I feel like the older generation is just like, well, you got to get a job and you got to work and put food on the table. And then gradually now it's like, well, I don't want to commit to a job until I feel like it's absolutely the right one for me. And guess what? You're not going to feel like that probably with your first or second or third or even your fifth job, right? The whole point is just to dig in, find out what you like and don't like, get experience, meet people, make connections, and then go to your next job. So it's okay if that first step isn't going to be your forever step. But I think that sometimes people get decision paralysis, like I'm supposed to find my calling right now. And then, of course, in this day and age, there's a lot of different other jobs that just weren't open to us before, like YouTube creator. Mm-hmm. Like that wasn't a thing when I was younger. So people are sometimes also thinking, well, maybe I can skip a couple steps and just achieve internet fame. And that also takes away from their ability to just say, I just got to do a little bit of the grind. Just dip your toe in, see if you like it. If you don't, move on. And that's totally normal to be feeling like that and in their 20s. But if these tools might assist the Strong and the Kierzy, then definitely check those out. And you can use those when you're older too. You know, if you're like kind of thinking about a second career, or maybe you're moving into retirement, you're like, oh, what kind of hobbies should I take on? Those are good assessments for that too.
And I've said this often, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I want to do this job till I die. It's what I've always wanted to do. And I was blessed and fortunate and lucky enough to have it and to get it and to hold on to it. But have there ever been studies done about how many people, when all is said and done, when they get to retirement age or whatever, that they look back with regret or they look back with satisfaction?
Yeah, that's just such a good question. I'm going to look up to see if there's any recent studies on that and get back to you. But, you know, I think that
anecdotally,
it's actually higher than you think.
I was going to say anecdotally.
Yeah, I would say that the number is higher than you think. I think that sometimes people think, oh, well, if I look back, I'm going to have all these things that I wish I had done instead. But I think that from what I hear and from what I see, most people have a lot about their lives that they can look back that they're satisfied by. It might not be career, right? It might be something else. It might be that they're satisfied about how they spent their time on the weekends or how they were with their family or how they pursued their hobbies. But I think that more people than you would think are satisfied with how they chose to spend their lives and who they spent it with.
All right, we're getting ready to walk out of church. Leave them with a thought, Dr. Judy, of if you're feeling burned out, what can you do to make it better? Deal with it.
Make sure that you do self-care every single day in some way, as long as it's intentional and that you know it's something that you're doing just for yourself. Even something that's 5 or 10 minutes is helpful and important. So that's what I would say, is make sure to prioritize that. Self-care is essential for your mental and physical health. It's not a luxury.
Thank you, Dr. Judy. Have a great day. You and Luca, and you can have Luca go at, how old is he now?
He's 3.
3. He can go take that Strong Interest Inventory or the Kierzy Assessment. Let me know how it turns out.
Exactly. Put him to work. Thanks, Tommy.
Thank
Talk
you.
To you soon.
You bet. Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. We'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.